Matthew chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. When Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee, heard about Jesus, he said to his advisors, "This must be John the Baptist raised from the dead. That is why he can do such miracles." For Herod had arrested and imprisoned John as favor to his wife Herodias, the former wife of Herod's brother Philip. John had been telling Herod, "It is against God's law for you to marry her." Herod wanted to kill John, but he was afraid of a riot because all the people believed John was a prophet.
I would encourage you to keep your places marked here in Matthew chapter 14. We're going to be looking at the subject of John the Baptizer, and we're going to note at this point his death. And as we consider his death and the events surrounding his death, it's a very compelling story. It's kind of one that's sort of shocking. It's one that's sometimes hard to reconcile with the understanding of how people can treat one another or how we deal with each other. Of course, we notice some things about the character of the various ones that are entailed in this particular incident that sort of give us insights as to how people can respond in a wrong way and those that stand for what's right. And certainly John the Baptizer is going to be an individual that's demonstrating what kind of person we ought to be in character and behavior and conduct. We see with John, as we look at his life, he had a very specific purpose, and he was the one who had prepared the way for the Messiah. He did so by going out in situations that were challenging in the sense that he wasn't looking for ease of life and luxury, but he was out there where he was amongst the wilderness areas, people coming to him, seeking him. He was preaching, teaching, he was baptizing in preparation. He was humble in spirit. His humility is demonstrable by how he conducted himself, and that at one point in time, as he's pointing to Jesus and some of the disciples are talking about that matter and how the people are starting to follow after Jesus and leaving John, John says, "He must increase and I must decrease." He recognized his role. And as we come to his death, we find then that while he's humble, that doesn't translate the idea that he's not bold in proclamation of truth. Indeed, we discover that in all senses, in every respect, that he stood for what was right. He told the individuals who came to him, in one instance where there were those who came more out of curiosity or for other purposes rather than genuine, sincere desire to know what was right, he called them out. He referred to them as vipers, and the idea of this concept and mentality that they possessed, come bringing fruits of repentance. So he is bold in proclamation of truth while humble in spirit. Those are not contradictory. One's humble by being submissive unto the Lord in all things. So here's John's death. And as we start looking at this and begin to consider some aspects of it, we first look and think about John's imprisonment. In Matthew chapter 14, in that reading that we just had, we look at verses 3 through 5. "For Herod had laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife." When you go to Mark, the 6th chapter, there's Mark's account of these events, and amongst the things that he states there, as Mark gives information, he says, "For he had married her." So it goes on. Here's the, "Because John said to him, 'It's not lawful for you to have her.'" Mark's account includes the fact that he had married her. "And although he wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude because they counted him as a prophet." Indeed, Mark's account also says that as you start looking at it, Herod recognized him as a holy man, that this one was of exceptional character. So he feared the people because he was considered a prophet. But even Herod, and this is Herod Antipas, this is the one of the sons of Herod the Great. After Herod's death, his kingdom was divided up among some of his children. And here's this Herod Antipas, and he's the one that's under consideration here. He had a brother named Philip. Think about this as a half-brother. And this Philip was married to Herodias, And now, as a result of what's transpired, we'll talk about this and look at it more extensively, but we see that he's married this woman. Herod Antipas has married her. And what we find is, John says you don't have a right to her. And because of Herodias, Herod imprisoned him. The denouncing of that adultery is what caused John to be imprisoned. John didn't have to speak up. If he hadn't said anything to Herod, Herod would have not taken him. Herodias, as we see her mentality and disposition and what her desires are, he would not have been in jeopardy. He could have ignored it, left it alone. After all, this is the king. Consider the fact this is not just anybody that you're now going to challenge their conduct and behavior and point out the reprehensibleness of what they're doing. This is the king. He has authority, he has power, such that he could imprison him. Indeed, there was a point in time of the idea of wanting to put him to death, and that hadn't yet come, though there was a desire on the part of Herodias to do so. In Exodus 20, verse 14, we see in those Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery. The idea of adultery, that's unfaithfulness on the part of one's spouse to engage in sexual immorality. In fact, Matthew 5:32, Jesus spoke of that subject matter and talking about adultery and the wrongfulness of it. And he put it in the context of marriage. The marital relationship and union that is sacred, that the Lord himself instituted, that he put in place, that you go back into the accounts of Genesis, that after creating man, he created woman for man, and the two became one flesh. That this husband-wife relationship that is intended for life. As you look at this, to go and marry someone else, when marriage and divorce and marry someone else is adultery. Because it's contrary to God's teaching instruction about the arrangement and the relationship and how one is to then go about and live accord to showing that proper attitude and behavior toward their spouse, living rightly, the faithfulness, sexual purity. In 19:9, what you find there is that it describes then that as Jesus is discussing it, just as he did in Matthew 5:32, he describes it in a way when they challenge this idea of the divorce and this idea of then what transpires and the wrongfulness of divorce and remarriage for any cause. And if you marry somebody, you commit adultery, you divorce them, you commit adultery. Those who go and marry another commits adultery. The sole exception to that is the unfaithfulness. If the innocent party, then that's where the immorality has been done on the part of their spouse, that frees them to be able to marry another. But that's the sole exception that we find. Here's John pointing out to Herod that he had no right to his brother's wife, and therefore he had married her, and it was an adulterous relationship. And that's why he was imprisoned. The willingness to preach and teach and expressly set forth what the Lord demands of us. In this day and time, when we have divorce and remarriage rampant, it permeates our society. It's easy sometimes to overlook that and to ignore the situation. But the Scriptures clearly teach what's right on these matters, and we have to go and examine God's Word in light of our lives. And if one's living in a wrongful state, they need to cease that state, whatever it is. And come out of that in order to come to the Lord in a right way, humbly and submissively. And to correct that which is amiss in their life. And so when we are dealing with situations and have Bible studies and which we're studying with people and we're looking at their circumstances and kind of going through and wanting to teach them the truth, we want them to obey the gospel, to be baptized for the remission of their sins, to be raised to walk in newness of life. Yet if there's something there that is not right in their life, they're living a life that is contrary to God's will, they're going to have to change that. You can't continue to live in sin. Baptism washes away previous sins. It puts us right with the Lord, but it doesn't permit a wrongful state to persist and continue. John pointed out to Herod he was living in adultery by being with a Herodias. Just touch on this. I wanted to highlight this part. Was an abuse of civil government. when you look at this, Herod, we're not talking about whether he had the power to do it. He absolutely had the power to take and put John in prison. He not only had the power, he utilized that power. The question is not a matter of power, a question of right. Is it right? Was it proper? Is it something that as a person in a position of authority, is that something that should be done? Or is it abusive and goes contrary to what is to be done according to what God intended? We mentioned about the marriage relationship. Marriage itself was instituted by God. So was government. Government was instituted by God for some very specific purposes. To not have those in positions of authority results in chaos and anarchy. And you see in history, time and again, events and circumstances in which government collapses and people are doing everything they are choosing to do on their own. Might makes right. This is a matter in which things that are just, there is no societal situation in which there are protections and provisions being made. So government is essential. The functioning of a society requires those in positions of authority. God understood that. The Lord himself instituted it. He also then described how it's to be done. What's to be done as it's intended as he set it forth. And so you read in Romans 13, 1 through 7, how the government was there for the purpose. It did not wield the sword in vain. That is, it was to punish. But the nature of the punishment was for the evildoer, for the person who was a law breaker, the laws that would be rightfully implemented. So people are not going off and doing wrongful things and treating others in ways that are not right, not pursuing a course that allows society to function correctly. But it is also to protect the innocent, those that are law abiders, that those are that are doing what's right. And we see in history as well that there are instances and times when laws and those in government and those in positions of authority abuse it, mistreat their own citizens, do things that are reprehensibly wrong. The scriptures are not condoning that. God is not approving that any more than he approves an adulterous marriage, even though he instituted marriage. The way in which marriage is to be carried out, God has also stipulated. The way in which government is to function, God set forth. And we can see the distinction there. Here, Herod abused his position. May not be uncommon if you look at instances, again, historically or situations that occurred, or even in the scriptures where Rome, through various purposes to appease the Jews on occasions, you know, persecuted Christians. That certainly was not something approved of by God, and government was in a position. But here it even says you are to be subject to those who rule over you. And we're to follow the laws of the land unless they conflict with God's laws. And we're to pay our taxes and show honor and treat others correctly, and that includes within the governing arrangement. But there's an abuse of power in this sense or situation. 18, that should be noted in Acts 18, 12 through 16. So if you're taking notes, I left out the particular book that to take note of, and that's Acts 18, 12 through 16. There was an incident in which Paul was going to be brought up before the magistrate, and the Jews were bringing him, and this is one occasion in which it kind of shows the proper understanding of how things should be, or at least in this isolated incident. When they're brought, it says, well, no, if this is about your laws and your religious beliefs, you take care of it. I don't have time for it. And he sent him away. Paul didn't even have to speak on his behalf. Another occasion there in the 25th chapter of Acts, when he's, again, Festus, before Festus, Paul is brought before him as the governor of Rome. And when he's making his own then appeal, when he's given the opportunity to speak on his behalf, Paul says, if I've done something wrong, if I've broken the law, then you know, I will take the punishment, even death. He recognized that that correctness of the government's functioning and the rightfulness of the government to uphold these laws and do it. But he says, I'm an innocent person. The charges are false. And so you see these occasions in which the unfolding of what is taking place. And when we see government and its proper place as God instituted and designed it, then these abuses are observable. We find that Herod's foolish oath is noted. Again, let's note these verses in the 14th chapter of Matthew. Picking up our reading here in this instance, in verse 6. But when Herod's birthday was celebrated, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. Therefore he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. So she, having been prompted by her mother, said, "Give me John the Baptist's head here on a platter." And the king was sorry. Nevertheless, because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he commanded it should be given to her. So he sent and laid John, he sent and had John beheaded in prison. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. There's the readings continue on there from a standpoint just of what happens then with the body of John. But notice as we look at this aspect of it and as it's described, what occurs? Herod makes a foolish oath. He blurts out something, and he does so at the moment, the occasion, sort of set the arrangement for him to go forth and say, "I'm going to give you whatever you want." If you again go over to the account that you find in Mark chapter 6, when he tells then Herodias' daughter that she could have anything she desired, he said, "Up to half my kingdom." Now, that may be an exaggeration. It may have, stated in a way just to show how expansive it was. But the point still being is he's saying, whatever you desire, I'll see to it. I promise you this. I'm giving this oath, a vow I've made to you. In the presence of those around about me, you can have whatever you ask of me, up to half my kingdom. So why did he do that? Well, due to his lust. First of all, let's kind of think of the setting. Let's think of the occasion that's transpiring here. Herod's having this feast and festival, and it has to do with the events associated with what's going on and at that moment. And so he's celebrating, and as he brings in these very powerful, influential ones that are part of his ruling class, they come. They're influential, as I say. They've got a status, position. He wants to maintain favor with them. After all, he wants to maintain his own position, and currying favor with them helps that. So they're all part of this big party. And the party, what's going on with this party? Well, the party, you're drinking, you're carrying on, you're eating, feasting. I mean, it's a big festival type of setting and drinking. So he'd been obviously consuming alcoholic beverages, drinking these various things, and then opportunity for intoxication, or at least he's inebriated to some extent. That would be an normal, understandable arrangement associated with that. The other day we had a lesson on the idea of the social drinking, or this idea of recreational drugs, which is what social drinking is, and the wrongfulness of engaging in such practices and behavior. One thing that you start to see in conjunction with that is how it affects the thought processes. One of the immediate things that occurs is one begins to lose any type of recognition of their own clarity of thought and awareness around them of what's going on. You may say things, you may have some degree of comprehension, but it starts to get then lessened and reduced. So now we look and see some things that take place, and here comes Herodias' daughter, and she's going to dance. Now, what's inferred in this, and again, Mark's account, the inference is there. What's inferred is that it's a provocative type of thing. It creates and excites the senses. The sexual stimulation that comes from viewing and observing what's transpiring. And that Herod himself is looking upon this. And that is creating then this kind of disposition in his mind that leads, coupled with these other things going on, and the whole festive occasion and the enthusiasm and excitement that's associated with it, to make this oath that foolishly said whatever you want without any limitations or qualifying comments. Galatians 5 and verse 19, the works of the flesh include among other things. Some of the translations, it's lustfulness or licentiousness or lasciviousness. Some of these terms are kind of, you know, words that, as it relates to some things of our being able to understand or comprehend, you have to look at them a little bit more in order to sometimes associate other words with them. But that, just the words themselves, we would recognize they don't sound appropriate and right and things that ought to be part of what's a person's life and their works of the flesh. I heard a definition of this idea of licentiousness, lasciviousness. It's to feel, to show, to cause lust. I think that's a pretty practical definition that gives us a sense of what's being described there. To feel, to show, to cause lust. Here she was in an inappropriate attire. We would talk about the idea of something that was worn that is indecent, immodest. In fact, you dress in the manner and way in order to cause or show attention to oneself in this manner of the behavior and conduct. And the dancing and the provocative movement and the swaying and the things that are going on in order to then, as entertainment, draw this to everybody's attention. And Herod is just taking it all in. He's absorbing these things. In 2 Samuel 11, verse 2, you have the incident that we know about and recorded in history, biblically, that describes David and what was some things about David and his downfall. He's up on the roof going about. It's perhaps inferred in the context of these events that he should have actually been someplace else and with his army in the field. Be that as it may, he's up on the roof, he's looking down, and across the way he's able to view Bathsheba bathing. And his lust is excited by the viewing of her in that sense. Instead of looking away, instead of controlling himself, he allows these thought processes and this desire on his part, the lustfulness, to lead to him to have her brought to him. And then, of course, we see the events as they unfold from there. The consequences of it, and sin leading to another sin. Here's the foolish oath that was excited by the lusts of Herod. You look then and also see due to his pride. Now we have this other factor associated with this, the pride. What was the nature of the pride in this case? Well, again, you look at the accounts of certainly Matthew 14 we read. You compare that with Mark 6 and some of the things that are added to just to give some more aspects associated with what's going on and the importance of these individuals that were present. I made an oath. I said I would do this. I may regret it, which he certainly did. He acknowledged his regret because of the request that came from it. The asking for John, the baptizer's head on a platter. That this was something that was truly disturbing. He recognized John as a holy man. He listened to John, as Mark's account says. He desired to hear him, even though John had rebuked him sharply for his wrongful situation in life, his immoral circumstance and living in an adulterous relationship with Herodias. Nonetheless, he listened to him. So now you've got this situation. So why didn't you just say, oops, made a mistake? Let's review this for a minute. Up to half my kingdom, and you can't have John's death as part of this. You know, why didn't you just say, choose something else? Because of pride. You know, in 1 John 2 and verse 16, it talks about the world, if things are part of the world or this worldliness falls into these categories. There's the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. Here's this pride of life, and in this concept of the pride of life, you have a situation in which now Herod has made this oath in front of all these other people, and he wasn't going to back down, though he wishes he hadn't done it. He was now in a circumstance in which he now had stated and made this promise, and he was going to keep it. Pride entered into the scene. I'm the king. I set this up. I made the promise. I've got to fulfill it. Look at these people around about me. What will they think of me if I don't do this thing? One thing about oaths, and the Bible doesn't condemn every oath by any means. There's oaths that we can take, and in fact, we make agreements, and sometimes these agreements have to do with legal binding documents that we swear to that we're going to fulfill our obligation. Now, the thing that the Scriptures warn about is you don't have to take an oath in order to fulfill your word. You need to keep your word regardless, and that's set forth. But there are things that are stated, and we may say things that blurt out in ways and without giving careful thought. Maybe in some instances, things that are going on, just like a case such as what we're describing here, and say, make a promise that one should have never engaged in. Well, we shouldn't let pride say we're going to fulfill that oath. We should acknowledge the wrongfulness of having done it, make correction of that. We're certainly not going to engage in wrongful conduct in order to fulfill something we should have never promised to start with. Just care needs to be taken in when we speak and how we speak, that we're knowledgeable about the things we're saying so that we can both do it honestly and also not put ourselves in places and make even promises we know we can't keep. One of the real quick, another aspect of this, if we go and put ourselves where we're trying to, then because we desire something, we want it so bad, that we're going to go purchase it, even if we don't have the wherewithal financially to do it, but we want it so bad, and we make an agreement and desire, having done this legal document, then we need to fulfill our obligation in regard to that. So care must be taken. Think about what we're doing prior to doing it. And so this idea of our obligations need to be thought of in that respect as well. In Proverbs 6, and Proverbs 6 kind of stands out as a verse in conjunction with what we're looking at here. In Proverbs 6 and verse 17, a proud look. Of course, the proud look, this person that is filled with pride and the way in which that's like, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood. Prior to that, it says six things, yea, seven things that are an abomination to God. Here are three of those that are listed. Isn't it interesting, just as an observation, the reason I connected this particular verse, is your proud look, and now you have hands that shed innocent blood. There are correlations sometimes that you see with the way of behavior and conduct that people have and what they do. So Herod's foolish oath was made, and it came as a result of lust, and it was fulfilled or went through the process because of pride. Herodias' vindictiveness. We already looked at the verses there that talked about this, and of course Herodias, when you have her daughter coming, when this promise is made, the oath taken, immediately what's her response? You know, there's all kinds of possibilities there that would be available, and yet the one thing she chooses is that John's head be put on a platter. She didn't just want his death. She wanted to see his head on a platter. Now, think about that for a moment, just the extent to which we're talking about here. It's not just the idea that I want to get this person out of my life and I want to remove them from the scene. I'm angry about what they've said. I'm distressed by the events around about. I want to have his head on a platter. I want it brought to me. Pretty vindictive, isn't it? To see the results of this and in order to get some then satisfaction from the very idea of that death, and I want to see that head on the platter. Well, that's what you find here. He says to get him beheaded in verse 10, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. It goes on, the disciples came and took away the body and buried it and went and told Jesus. When we read this, of course, all of these different factors and talk about the character of the individuals, the behavior and the conduct, and then we're trying to wrestle somewhat with just how the mentality and to what extent some of these things exist, and then you look at Herodias' vindictive disposition, it's pretty clearly evident, is it not, that when you don't only want the death, but you want the head. I want to see it. Attitude of hatred. Hatred that we allow to be within us, that just swells within an individual. It just kind of builds up. Unhappiness about something and angry about something and lending itself to being the hate that is noted. It's an attitude to start with. It begins with this disposition of an attitude. And one dwells upon this idea of the hatred that we have. She certainly had a hatred, and it was not being satisfied. She was unhappy that John was still alive. in this instance. But we can relate to this in other ways. There are people we get upset with, and sometimes we just get furious with them, perhaps. I'm human nature some occasions. So how do we address that? Well, we certainly don't allow ourselves to dwell on those things and begin to let that get into our minds and become such fixation on us that the hatred that we have towards somebody begins to just be something that's part of our life, whoever it is. To allow that is a corrupting influence, detrimental. In Hebrews 10, verse 12, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. The covering of sins is not suggesting by any means that sinful behavior, wrongful conduct is to be overlooked. It's saying that our attitude and disposition toward an individual, that love, it's not one of wanting or desiring wrongfulness on their part or doing things that way. The attitude that exists there. So you have this, Galatians 5 and verse 20. Hatred, again, is part of the works of the flesh. You start looking at these categories, and the works of the flesh is an aspect of what we see that comes, and all kinds of things flow from that, and all types of evil occur. It results in hurting others. Many times it results in hurting others. It certainly hurts ourselves when we dwell on this and allow that to become fixated in our minds. It's certainly not healthy for a number of reasons for that to be the case. There are any number of passages perhaps could be used to sort of make this point. And I'll just take one passage. We'll make some observations based on that and then enable us to kind of see how that can be manifested. Because certainly in this instance, how it's manifested is murder, death. An innocent person is put to death in a very horrendous manner in order to satisfy the then oath that was given and the vindictive nature of the person who made the ultimate request or the ultimate order associated with wanting that to be fulfilled, to have that accomplished. If you look at the third chapter of Titus, verses 3, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving various lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy, hateful and hating one another. So it's descriptive here of these things about how we speak, how we treat, how we deal with each other. And while I submit to you that the likelihood that any of us are going to, as a group, the idea that I'm going to be so hating of somebody that I'm going to go take their life, that I'm going to go out and physically do some physical harm to them in that manner or way, leading to murder, for example, injury of that way of a physical type, nonetheless, we can be hurtful to each other by the way we speak and talk and what we say and how we conduct ourselves. That is far more apt to be the case, is it not? I want to strike out against somebody, so I'm going to say something to them to be hurtful to them. I in fact, there's a danger. Yeah, backtrack just for a minute. Have you ever had the experience that something in your mind and you're just really unhappy with somebody and you just wish that something happened to them and bad? First, have you ever had that? Yeah, I would submit to you that through the years, times, I've wrestled with some things like that. I've had that. You got, whoa, backtrack. This is not right. You know, this is not the attitude that we ought to have. This is not the manner and way which we're to deal with one another. So even thinking about that, if you allow that to dwell, what's going to be the consequence of it? When I get an opportunity to do something that I can hurt that person, you know, occasion comes up, I can hurt that person. Go for it. And then a certain smug satisfaction of having done that. Don't I feel good? We ought not. And it ought to be something that we suddenly realize this is not. What satisfaction comes from that type of a mentality? What can possibly be good when one has that type of disposition of heart? The heart, the mind, removing that and dealing with the right and bringing oneself with the right mindset is a constant ongoing thing that we need to be working on. And then we're going to deal with things rightly and correctly. That mindset that we need to have. The attitude of hatred leads to being injurious of others in some way, if we have an opportunity to do so, or smug satisfaction of having accomplished that and feel good that I got them. And that attitude is wrong, sinful. There's a last point here, and that's Herod's guilty reaction. Go back to Matthew 14 in the first couple of verses. In Matthew 14, we've looked at the account. We backtrack here in the early part of these verses. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the report about Jesus, said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He's risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him." For Herod had laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother's wife. With the first two verses, we see what Herod does. But it's talking about Jesus, hearing about Jesus and Jesus' activities. So what does Herod immediately think? What comes to his mind? Who is this individual? Well, he's John. Look what he's doing now. He's John. Herod is haunted with this guilty conscience about what he had done to this individual that he recognized as holy and undeserving of what occurred to him. And Herod had that part to play. In fact, because of Herod's position and because of what Herod did, the foolishness of Herod, the behavior and conduct of Herod, and then allowing Herodias to have her opportunity, Herod recognized his own guilt in that entire scenario. And he was bothered by it, or he wouldn't have thought it. He could have done it without any regard at all, go take care of it, and then he's done. Hear about this person over here. Who is that guy over there? It wouldn't have mattered to him. But he immediately thought of John because of his conscience. And some things there that we want to take note of, the value and purpose of the conscience. The conscience is given to us for a very specific purpose by the Lord. It's that red alert. It's that which signals something that's awry. It causes us to pause and ponder and think about what we're doing in life and the correctness or rightness of it. In 1 Corinthians 8, verse 7, and this is dealt with in the context, incidentally, of that which is liberties or allowable that God has not legislated. But it does talk about it this way, and it helps us understand the significance of the conscience. It's that something may be allowable, but it's bothersome to us. How do we respond to that? We've come from a background, a situation in which certain practices are done, which are not wrong in and of themselves, but they're connected with some wrongful behaviors, and we've come out of these practices, and we're having trouble differentiating between that practice and that it's not wrong in and of itself, but because it's connected to us, our conscience bothers us. And what's the answer? Don't do it. Don't violate the conscience. We need to educate the conscience. We need the conscience to understand from perspective of God's word, and we become to the point where we recognize what's right and it doesn't bother us. But if we start to just arbitrarily go against our conscience, if we start just ignoring those things, then what transpires is we find in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 2, what's described there is the searing of the conscience. No longer becomes that valuable asset that the Lord gave us. Now, a conscience does not make something right nor wrong per se. The Word of God does. As we say, educate the conscience with the Word of God so we can deal with situations. If I come to that knowledge of truth that this is not a problem, it doesn't affect my conscience, then I can go ahead and do that. I need to do it. And if my conscience doesn't bother me, it doesn't make it right either. It's not a question of the conscience, again, as such, but it is part of what God has given us to help us to live rightly before Him. And we don't want to share that conscience. We don't want to get to the point where we're not troubled by wrongful behavior and ungodly conduct. That we can get past that thing by searing it, and so it no longer has that feeling, like something that's been seared in the skin. No longer has the sensitivity to what's going on, so it doesn't bother us. In John 8, verses 3 through 11, there's the account of those individuals who brought the woman that was caught in the very act of adultery before Jesus. And they said, "What should we do with her? The Mosaic law says stone her." Of course, there's a lot of things about that we're not going to get into all the particulars. Suffice it to say that the man wasn't brought as well. It's just the woman. It's not intended in order to really carry out something in a rightful way. It's in order to ensnare and trap Jesus. So we have how Jesus deals with this incident. And as he's first kneeling down, kind of ignoring them, and finally he says, "You without sin, cast the first stone." And as he's back to not looking at him and everything, then the oldest to the youngest begins to leave. What was affecting them? Their conscience. They realized that their situation, the very fact that they brought this person and the reason behind having brought them had nothing to do with what was right. Their conscience bothered them. They left. Jesus didn't ignore the wrong or the sin. He said, "Go your way and sin no more." He says, "You know, you're forgiven, but don't." He's not condoning the behavior. The value and purpose of our conscience that we see there. And the remedy is to confess and repent of sin. That in order to rectify things, here again, Herod, his conscience bothered him. He recognized there was a sense of guilt. It was such that it caused him to have some thoughts that immediately came about with something that was totally, as far as these events were concerned, Jesus not being John. But he thought, "Hey, here's John, he's come back. And he's doing these things." In 2 Corinthians 7:10, though, godly sorrow talks about godly sorrow. And that the idea of godly sorrow unto repentance leads to salvation. This godly sorrow, genuine sorrowfulness over that which is wrong. In 2 Samuel 12, verses 7 through 13, this is that occasion. Go back to David's account when we talk about David and the sins that followed after the events that occurred where he looked upon Bathsheba to lust after her, brought her to him, engaged in adultery, and then the death of Bathsheba's husband, engineered by David. Nathan the prophet confronts him, and when Nathan the prophet confronts him, David recognized that he sinned. He said, "I've sinned against God." And finally, just to kind of see the disposition and talk about the guilty conscience and then the remedy that's observed in this instance where sin's involved and these wrongful behaviors are noted, we see there that David the psalmist writes about the relief he has after what Nathan, in doing this and his acknowledgement of it, of his sin. He also describes what he felt prior to this being the case. "Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, in whose spirit there is no deceit. When I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was taken to the drought of summer. I acknowledge my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgressions to you, Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin." That burden lifted. All those things that were felt and David recognized, David wasn't ignorant. He allowed himself to be caught up and swept away. He didn't control himself and stop, but once he got into it, then he had all these other aspects that came along until finally, and when confronted, he acknowledged it. And when these things were corrected, he still had to live with the consequences in a physical sense and circumstances around the death of the child, the upheaval in his own family. But his own sins had been forgiven. His relationship with God had been restored. And it was that burden that was lifted. We're about to sing a song of encouragement and think about these verses and think about our circumstance. Certainly, if one has yet to obey the gospel, then we need to be baptized, we talked about earlier in our lesson, for the remission of sins, to be raised to walk in newness of life. But we also need to examine ourselves to make sure we're living as we should, and that we're serving the Lord faithfully and not allowing sin to be that which dominates our life. Set those things aside. If there's things privately and dealing with matters associated with it and get those things corrected, then the Lord stands ready. He desires to pray to Him, to acknowledge these things that are wrong and to live a life that's pure and holy in His presence. But if it's of a public nature, something that you need to share, something that you need in order to be right with the Lord, in order to have that guilt of sin removed, because the Lord's promised that if we do those things, He will forgive, and His promises are sure. If you stand subject to this call in any way, won't you please come forward, and together we stand and sing.